Labor Department announced an unexpected jump in first-time claims for jobless benefits at the end of January. Initial unemployment claims increased by 35,000, the highest level in 26 years. The total number of people collecting jobless benefits has climbed to a record 4.79 million. According to veteran journalist and frequent Uprising guest Chris Hedges, quote, "The daily bleeding of thousands of jobs will soon turn our economic crisis into a political crisis." Companies are laying workers off faster than expected in an attempt to survive the recession, but the growing controversy over excessive CEO pay and incentives, particularly those receiving government bailout money, has angered Americans. In response, President Barack Obama announced a salary cap for those companies yesterday as he struggles to make the case for his economic stimulus package. But, says Hedges, there is nothing President Obama can do to stop the downward economic decline, as it has been decades in the making. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, senior fellow at the Nation Institute currently, author of several books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, I Don't Believe in Atheists, and his latest, Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. Welcome back to Uprising, Chris.
Thank you.
So I have to say, I got pretty depressed reading your article. It is a depressing scenario. And you lay it out pretty clearly that well before things are going to get better, they're going to get worse and a lot worse. How worse? What should we expect?
Well, I think all of the signs point to a period that will probably parallel the experience the country went through during the Great Depression, with a couple important and I think frightening differences. In the 1930s, we had powerful movements on the left, progressive forces, labor unions, an independent press. We didn't have a corporatized press that ranged, of course, from Hearst newspapers all the way to the Catholic Worker, and that's gone. And so I think that the counterforces to radical right-wing movements, and these movements always arise in times of economic turmoil and deprivation, are not going to have the impediments they had before. I of course, look at the radical Christian right in this country as not a religious movement but a mass movement with the and of course, the engine of all of these movements is despair, personal and economic despair. And as more and more Americans are not only thrust from their jobs but face being thrust from their homes, as we continue to funnel money upwards towards Wall Street and investment banks, the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, we really set the stage for not only a very frightening economic decline, but a period of deep political dislocation.
Now, could some of this have been averted had those who were sounding the alarm, had they been listened to years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago even? And who are some of the people who are saying that this was in the making? And they, you know, certainly they weren't people at the Wall Street Journal printed.
Well, that's part of the problem. I mean, you touch on it, and it's an important part of the problem, because there were certainly voices. You know, let's just start with Ralph Nader, who were sidelined by the mainstream, and not just the mainstream press, but the mainstream political establishment, and, of course, the universities. People who had searing and, I think, in retrospect, correct critiques of unfettered capitalism and what it does to a society, of globalization, were just not given a hearing. In this article that you draw from on Truthdig, I quote Sheldon Wolin, who is one of the country's great political philosophers, without question, taught first at Berkeley and then at Princeton. And he has a new book that I highly recommend called Democracy Incorporated, where he talks about the specter of inverted totalitarianism and how the face of totalitarianism doesn't always rise in its classical form but can come through essentially corporatism. Even in publications like the New York Review of Books, and which you would think would cling to a kind of intellectual independence, he was essentially banished from the pages. So these voices in this giddy pursuit of wealth, which we now know it wasn't just Bernie Madoff, but was in essence a giant Ponzi scheme. We're not given a hearing, and we are paying the price for essentially sidelining those people who offered powerful and important critiques of what was happening to our capitalist economy.
Do you foresee, Chris, that in the bleak future we face, and when I say we, I mean ordinary Americans, that those who benefited from this irrational exuberance, if you will also suffer, or are they going to make off with our money?
Well, part of what's happened, both economically and politically, is that we have created an oligarchic class. And what you see with the stimulus package and the bailout is that oligarchic class protecting itself. And unfortunately, President Barack Obama has bought into this idea that sustaining a dysfunctional system. Why, for instance, was AIG bailed out? Well, AIG was bailed out because Goldman Sachs had invested $20 billion in AIG. Where did that money go? What did AIG do? Well, in essence, in AIG provided insurance for large numbers of mortgages that bankers knew would go bad. And Goldman Sachs would have gone under because AIG would not have been able to pay out that money that Goldman Sachs had invested in the company, which is why Paulson got down on his knees, a former chairman, CEO of Goldman Sachs, to beg Nancy Pelosi to pass the bailout. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's going on. Dennis Kucinich has been, one out there, pointing a lot of this out. And unless, Obama, and, he's certainly a very intelligent guy, unless he charts a radical course, unless there is a radical break from the status quo, and I'm not very optimistic given the fact that people like Larry Summers are now in the White House. I mean, Larry Summers is largely responsible through the destruction of Glass-Steagall, along with Robert Rubin and others, for essentially turning commercial banks into investment houses. So I think he doesn't have much time. And how are we responding? Well, we're borrowing and we're printing money. I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, and that war was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the physical or the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia. We know from past scenarios, I mean, going all the way back to Weimar, that when you start printing money like this, you really raise the possibility of frightening and very serious inflation. So the indicators are not good. This has been decades in the making. The destruction of the manufacturing class, the rise of global capitalism, where essentially you have a transnational oligarchic elite with no loyalty to any country, any nation, and who is essentially reducing the working class both within and beyond our borders to a kind of subsistence level. We sustained a standard of living through essentially borrowing. And a whole house of cards is coming down. I mean, William Guider and others estimate that we probably have, $4 to $6 trillion in worthless assets, and we just don't have enough money to throw at it.
Now the sustaining of our standards of living and the price we pay for that, is this part of the inverted totalitarianism that Sheldon Wolin talks about?
Yeah, I would disagree with Wolin there, one does that with a great deal of humility. He's certainly a brilliant thinker. But Wolin's argument is that through what he calls inverted totalitarianism, you don't necessarily have a charismatic or a demagogue as a leader, but you create a political passivity by creating spectacle, the vast entertainment industry out there, and also giving people a level of personal comfort or consumer products that keep them mollified. Well, that isn't going to work anymore. People don't have the disposable income anymore to go out and buy huge flat screen TVs and SUVs and all the other sort of toys that in a consumer society I think did create political passivity. I worry very much that the Christian right, which has the organizing capacity that the left doesn't have through churches and megachurches dotted all around the country. And
which gives people community, a sense it gives, of community.
Yes, it gives people community. It gives people an authoritarian community. It's not a real community because the power centers of these megachurches, which function as small villages. I mean, I've been in many of the churches. I mean, there's literally restaurants with brunches and bowling alleys, and that's where the AA meets, and that's where childcare is, and that's where the woman's sewing club. I mean, and what they've done is you've had a rise in a very rigid authoritarian community where the leaders of these churches, who are invariably male and white, are never allowed to be questioned because, of course, they are in direct contact with God. Any kind of questioning or self-criticism becomes a form of backsliding, is satanic. But the rise of these, let's call them faux communities, has come in conjunction with the destruction, the physical destruction of real community. That's what poverty does. When you go to the former manufacturing centers in Ohio, places like Youngstown, you see how these communities have been ripped apart. They don't exist physically, with all the attendant problems of domestic abuse, drug addiction, alcohol abuse, broken homes. Then the list is endless. So you're very right that what we have is people will be retreating into these Christian authoritarian enclaves because they have nowhere else to go. And the left has no, progressives or those of us who care about an open society, we have no alternative to offer.
My guest is Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, senior fellow at the Nation Institute. We're talking about a piece that he wrote recently for Truthdig called It's Not Going to Be Okay. Now, linking this, what you just described earlier about how our standards of living have been, propped up by this economy and we're not going to have the ability to buy these toys to keep us passive anymore. What about the U.S. empire? Literally, our men and women and our military bases abroad, how do you link the U.S.'s overarching empire, particularly as it expanded under Bush, with the failure of the U.S. economy and what you foresee may be happening?
Well, that's a crucial point. We spend, $650 billion a year in our military. According to the CIA, the second largest expenditure on a national military is China, with $65 billion. We've spent 10 times more. It's not a new story. Empires invariably hollow themselves out from the inside by constant military expansion until finally that expansion is unsustainable. That, again, is something the Obama administration has unfortunately decided to pursue, especially in Afghanistan. You cannot question the military expenditures, the fact that half of all discretionary spending by the federal government goes into the military. It's not used to be raised 20 years ago by Democrats who would at least fight certain weapon systems. You never hear that now. Wolin makes a very funny point. He said, that we were sold this notion that government was bad, but somehow the military wasn't part of the government. We are crumbling internally, economically, and we are, and of course that's what empires do. They expand to the point where they there's an expansive quality to empire finally overreaches itself, and that's what we've done. So there's a confluence of very dangerous forces at work here, and that is economic collapse coupled with a massive and unsustainable empire. And those two forces, when they converge, or as they are converging, will mean crisis.
Now, there are those who say that President Barack Obama has the worst job in the country, if not the world, today. You also have said that there's pretty much nothing he can do. But you also mentioned earlier that there is a radical course that could be pursued. What sort of radical course, from the White House at least? I mean, not even necessarily talking about from the bottom up just yet, but what sort of radical course could Barack Obama and his administration pursue that could ease the pain that we are going to all be feeling, or if not already feeling?
Well, I think looking back at, you know, as the New Deal as a model, nationalizing the banks, which they may be forced to do anyway. Mm-hmm. Even John Kerry, who's hardly known as a political renegade, was saying calling a lot of the American banks zombie banks. You know, one of the terrifying things about the crisis is that the very people pulling the levers have no idea. They just don't know how much toxic debt they have. And one of the most disturbing things that we've seen in the last few days is that it's not just foreclosures. It's not just people who can't pay their mortgages, but now, of course, people who can't pay their credit card bills. I mean, it's not a surprise. That this is spreading to people who ostensibly have good credit ratings. So people just don't know. I mean, people within the financial system don't know. I think that in order for us to weather this crisis and salvage what is left of our open society, we really need a government that, rather than trying to mollify and prop up a broken financial system, one that, you know, by the laws of other periods in history and even other countries, is criminal. I mean, people like George Soros in the 17th and 18th century would have been hung. That's what you did. Literally, it was a crime. I mean, that's what you did with speculators. You know, and that's what hedge fund managers are. And that's what these large concerns like AIG and Morgan Stanley became. I think for me the most disturbing part of the Obama administration is looking at who he has decided to surround himself with. The fact that you would allow Larry Summers to give you daily briefings on the economy when it was Larry Summers who actively orchestrated the destruction of the regulatory agencies and the walls that were meant to protect us from this it's nonsensical.
Chris, I want to talk a little bit now about what ordinary people could do. I mean, you bring up, of course, the very sort of terrifying reality that many Americans, because of the economic woes, are going to be drawn to the mega churches and be pulled into the Christian right wing. But there are, of course, other paths. And an optimist might say, well, this might be the moment that Americans may realize that real community is going to pull them through, where farmers markets may flourish, where people may begin start to once more barter, and neighbors may help each other out and exchange goods. And, you know, maybe this is something that becomes that other inevitability. What do you think?
You're right. I mean, people will be forced into a kind of lifestyle which we should have voluntarily accepted some time ago. But what I fear is that as the economic situation becomes more untenable, we will see demonstrations, protests, but the power of the corporate state, which, and of course the rise of the corporate state always means the rise of the surveillance state, will see our oligarchic class essentially employ the very sophisticated techniques. I mean, we saw it at the Republican and Democratic convention.
Yeah, just the police state coming out in full
force
to quell civil unrest.
And it was, it was Orwellian in the forms of infiltration and electronic monitoring and absolute ruthlessness to make any counter-narrative heard. And, of course, we have a corporatized media, especially an electronic media, which rather than responsibly convey the concerns of those of people who are suffering and raise their voice in dissent, will do what they did to the anti-war movement after the invasion of Iraq, which is, if they ever give them a brief few seconds on the screen is essentially ridicule and belittle them as outside, as somehow not American, as outside the mainstream. So, and Wolin, this is Wolin's concern, and I share it, that we may see vibrant resistance, although I think it will be localized, but the tools and the capacity of the corporate state to shut it down, and the utter refusal on the part of our corporatized media to give a voice to this movement. I mean, remember that Martin Luther King may have been all for nonviolence, but he often had National Guard troops lining the streets, and he had a media that amplified his voice and the voice of the civil rights movement throughout the country. Mm. When you live in totalitarian states and you have the capacity to muzzle dissent and will employ ruthless mechanisms to contain or crush dissent, then you slip very quickly into despotism. Mm. And I think this has to be a very real possibility, and I think that there are, unfortunately, and we've seen it, we saw it over the summer, precedents that show that there is very, very little room to maneuver in this country anymore unless you stay within the very narrow parameters, narrative that is handed to us by those in power.
And it is at a time like this, then, not to sound too self-serving, but an institution like Pacifica is so crucial to bring this out.
Of course.
Krista, finally, let me ask you what you recommend in terms of, obviously, you're a writer, you're a journalist, you're an analyst, and you don't have all the answers, and you may not be wanting to offer all the answers or solutions. But any thoughts to listeners who, are frightened by what's to come, aside from, stay away from the mega church and don't believe that hype. But what else? What else can we do to, the line in your article that probably scared me the most was our children will never have the standard of living we had.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It isn't. Mm. A life dedicated towards consumption and personal hedonism is not necessarily healthy either for your body or your soul. So that doesn't frighten me. I think learning a certain humility and learning limitations, especially in a world where half of the population lives on less than $2 a day, is salutary for us as a nation. I think we have to walk out on the Democratic Party. I didn't vote for Obama. I voted for Nader. A lot of that had to do with the war. I think that the left has essentially rendered itself impotent by throwing in its lot with the Democratic Party, that over and over and over betrays the interests of the working and increasingly the middle class in this country. I mean, just look at the bailout. Constituent calls were running 100-1 against the bailout, and they pass it anyway. Why do they pass it? Because, lobbyists and corporate powers wanted it passed. The FISA Reform Act, which Barack Obama voted for, a giant step towards fascism. Why did it pass? Because the telecommunication companies spent $15 to $20 million in lobbying fees to make sure it got passed. The government at its core, and forget the rhetoric, forget the propaganda, forget, yes, we can, serves the interests of corporations. We are watching it now with the financial bailout. We are watching it in the absolute failure on the Democratic Party to challenge the rapacious cannibalization of the country by the military-industrial complex.
So just to bring that up then, do you mean supporting parties like the Green Party or building other independent parties or even abandoning the electoral system in particularly at a time when the economic crisis is going to hit us and focusing on those issues of localism and really rebuilding our communities from the grassroots up?
Well, I suspect that progressive politics will begin locally rather than national. I mean, I love Ralph. He's a friend, and I think his voice is important. But I think it will begin locally. I think we somehow have this idea that these candidates who are selected for us, by moneyed interests. You can't run for president unless corporations, you know, write the checks. And that somehow voting for this very limited spectrum is all we have to do. That's a very minor part and not even that an important part of what we do. So, yes, locally, I think we have to be willing to stand fast on issues and find within ourselves a new kind of militancy. Because if we don't, the other militants, the militants who want to destroy all the things that we care about, plurality, openness, tolerance for other ways of being, I don't even like the word tolerance, an acceptance of other ways of being other than our own, all of this will vanish.
Well, Chris Hedges, as always, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, senior fellow at the Nation Institute. His latest book is Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. You can also read the article we've been discussing today called It's Not Going to Be Okay at Truthdig. And Chris, you have a website too?
I don't, but I write every Monday for Truthdig.
Truthdig. All right. Well, that's the place to go. And we'll link to it from our website, kpfk.org/uprising, later today. Also, special thanks to Mansoor Sabag.